Good evening and welcome to the class. As we begin our study of Acts, or continue our study of Acts 17 tonight, we want to remember that Paul had left Silas and Timothy in Macedonia as he went on to Athens in the country of Greece or Achaia. And we see, and also in the First Thessalonian letter in chapter 3, we briefly alluded to this, that because of his concern for the church in Macedonia, he sent Timothy back. And then we see in the 18th chapter of the book of Acts, the next chapter, that as Paul has gone to from Athens to Corinth, he's waiting there for Silas and Timothy to join him. So what I'm suggesting to you is that there's some movement of these men that is certainly not detailed in the book of Acts. And we're not going to try to trace those movements. I don't know if we have enough scripture, enough information that we could, you know, accurately trace those things. But what I am suggesting to you is that Paul was concerned about these churches when he left them and went on to somewhere else. So he would send men back to check on their progress, to give them further teaching, and they would catch up with them perhaps in another city. So to see more about that, you can go ahead and look in the 1 Thessalonians letter chapter 3, and it may be the same as well for other cities. And so tonight we're going to pick up with him in the city of Athens in chapter 17, verse 16. In verse 16, Paul was waiting for them, that being Silas and Timothy, at Athens. When he had been conducted, helped on the way to Athens, he told the men who took him when they got back, to have Silas and Timothy come immediately. Don't know how long that took. It took some days for them to travel back. Maybe Silas and Timothy were readily available where these men went back to. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they were together. Maybe they weren't. And maybe they could leave immediately. Maybe they couldn't. Maybe one of them didn't come. Maybe one stayed and only one came. We don't know those details. But he's waiting for them there. And it says that while he was waiting, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Now, this idea of his spirit being provoked. Paul had gone there, and I don't know if he'd gone there with the intention of staying any longer than he had to. He may have not had that intention at all. But while he was there, as he was waiting, it says his spirit was provoked. Now, I remember in 79 and 80, I had occasion to make business trips into Las Vegas. And where Paul says here, the city was full of idols. Las Vegas, at that time, and I'm sure it's not any better now, was full of these, what we call one-armed bandits, these slot machines. And when we got off the airplane, and this was before the days of Homeland Security, when you could actually sit around and loiter in the where the, you know, you boarded the plane, the whole area would be just lined. Walls would be lined with these slot machines. And somebody was at every one of them, just throwing their money in there as fast as they could and pulling that arm down. So I leave the airport and I go to the hotel. Every hotel you go into, the lobby is the same way. So go to get a meal. And it doesn't matter where you go. If it's to, you know, a full-fledged restaurant, or if it was to a breakfast place like a Denny's, doesn't matter. They're out there, you know, the waiting area, just full of these one-armed bandits. And so that's when I read this, full of idols, I think of Las Vegas, just full of these one-armed bandits. And so here it is as a young child. In Las Vegas, when he goes to all the places that young children go to, they see this. It becomes a way of life. So when they're older, it's very difficult for them then to have an adverse reaction to it. It's been justified to them all their life. They don't even question it. And so it is in the city such as Athens, when their cities are full of idols. These young children grow up with this. It's their way of life. It's all they know. And as they grow older, so many will not see reason to question it. And so this concept of idol worship is a self-perpetuating concept. And so his spirit was provoked. Now, it's one thing to be provoked. It's another thing to be provoked to action. I remember some of the parents in high school where their children were playing in the band or singing in the choir. And here it would come Christmas time. And the teacher expects them to take part in all the Christmas going ons, that, you know, which would be centered around Christ. And these mothers would complain, "Oh, I hate this time of year. Oh, I'd just be glad when this is over." And they would get upset about it. But they never did anything about it. The children would still take part just like all the other children did. So provoked, you see, but not to action. Paul was provoked. And so what did he do? He says he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout person and the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Now, it doesn't say anything about any of the Jews actually being converted. Now, there's a statement at the very 34th verse. It names Dionysus, a woman named Demarius, and others with them. Perhaps some of these were Jews. But in Luke's way of writing, he certainly doesn't tell us specifically that any of the Jews and the devout Greeks obeyed. It says in verse 7, he reasoned with them. And he reasoned in the synagogues and he reasoned in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. It's perhaps that many of these Jews accepted idolatry. Perhaps. I don't know. But that's what happens to us. And we have to be careful ourselves that we don't accept the religious world around us. We don't accept the foreign religions, and I say foreign, I mean those that are not typically what we think of as religions in America. But we also have to be careful that we don't accept the denominational world, that we don't get so used to it that we just think of it as something acceptable to God or something that we don't need to concern ourselves with. I don't know if that's what happened to them, but I know this, that when you're around it and you're not fighting against it, you tend to have a sense of some level of acceptance of it. Certainly maybe the level of acceptance that would cause you not to speak out against it and to be quiet about it. So every day he's in the marketplace and he's discussing reasoning, it says, with anyone whom he could talk to. Here we have again this idea of reasoning. Now, we get reports from different men. The reports from Emilio Acevedo down in Chile. He goes talking about the marketplace. He'll have his little stand that he's made. He'll have some Bibles to give out, and he'll have tracts that he's written and printed out. And he will go to the marketplace, typically on a Saturday. He and some of his sons and other members of the church. He did the same thing in Sayana, Peru, if you have looked at the photos on his reports and have seen him doing the same thing there. They'll go to the marketplace, and they will talk with anyone who comes up to them, who would have a conversation with them. And so we have here in verse 18 some of the philosophers. And it names two different groups of philosophers. He says these also conversed with him. Now, who are these philosophers? It doesn't tell us, okay? You know, we can read books and they'll say, well, the Epicureans are this and the Stoics are this. And sure, there's some differences in them. But we're going to notice, as Paul goes through his reasoning, he doesn't distinguish between them. He doesn't say, now, to this group this and to this group this, because there's some basic tenets to both of those philosophies that are the same. Now, if you later on, and I know you'll know from earlier studies, he makes a distinction of the resurrection of the dead between a hostile audience and part of that group being Sadducee and part of that being Pharisee. So he makes a statement that he's here because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so then he, because of that, those two groups got to squabbling with each other. But in this case, he doesn't make any distinction between these. The basic tenets that they hold are essentially the same. They believe in polytheism. They don't believe in one God. They don't believe in the resurrection of the dead. They don't believe in eternal life. They don't believe in Jesus Christ. So the fact that there's some differences in them was not important to him. And it's the same thing when we talk about the denominational world. Certainly sometimes we want to get into this particular belief of some group and another belief process of some other group. But there's so much that's similar with them, some of those details don't really matter in some of the conversations we might have. For instance, most of them are going to believe in something about grace. Grace without works. Faith without works. They're going to, not be concerned with baptism for the remission of sins. They're going to believe in some inner working of the Holy Spirit, that the Spirit is required to understand the Word of God. Maybe the Spirit's even required to enact upon that Word that the Spirit has already helped you understand. So a lot of the tenets of some of the denominational world is the same. Now, obviously, if you get into a specific discussion with one particular person, you may have to get more specific than that. But certainly, for a lot of the teaching that we would do, the concepts from one denomination to another are very similar to one another. Certainly in this case, Paul didn't seem to distinguish in his discussion between the differences in the philosophies of these two groups. And so these conversed with him, and some says, what did this babbler wish to say? The idea, the basic word of babbler, it's not a complimentary word, okay? It originally meant seed picker, as a bird would pick seed. And through time, the word came to be known as one who would earn his living by picking scraps, such as scraps of food. And a matter of fact, if you'll notice in the New American Standard, I believe that's going to be in the footnotes. And then it became the idea of one who would pick the thoughts of others, okay, and present these thoughts as something that was thought-provoking in his own thoughts. And it's probably in this sense that they mean it. Paul has just heard this somewhere, and he's out spitting it out. It's not really his thoughts, and we've never heard such a thing like this. It's not a compliment to Paul to call him that. Others says he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and him crucified. You notice his message didn't change. He's always preaching Jesus and him crucified. It doesn't matter who the audience is. If it's the Jews and the devout Greeks that we saw in chapter 17, it doesn't matter who the audience is. It's Jesus and him crucified. We need to make sure that we don't change that message. The message is not about me or about you. It's not about us at all. It's about Jesus and him crucified. So if somebody rejects what you're saying, it needs to be that they understand they're rejecting Christ. They're not rejecting me, because I'm just going to say what I can read from and study from and hear. The rejection is of Christ. This idea of foreign divinities, certainly foreign in the concept of strange, something that they've not heard of. And I don't know all that they meant, if that's simply all they meant, or if they're teaching. He talked about, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit. And so they heard, these words and referred to them as foreign divinities. I don't know. But the preaching was about Jesus and him crucified, and it was something that they had never heard before. So they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Then it says in verse 21, now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except hearing or telling something that was new. Now, the idea of the Areopagus, I think the King James Version down in verse 22 is going to call it Mars Hill. And that's basically what I think what the term means in a translation. But it used to be an actual hill, my understanding is. But later on, and before this event, before this happened here in Acts 16, 17, the occasion of their convening was moved to someplace else. It wasn't actually on the place called Mars Hill. And so the term later became stood for not so much the location, but the fact that these men would come together and convene. And what they were doing, as I understand it, in their convening is they would listen to these philosophies that came from these other places. And they would basically pass a judgment on them. And so they've asked Paul now to come and speak to them. And the idea of their coming to speak is so that they can pass judgment on what this is that Paul is saying. Already we see that he's been accused of babbling. He's preaching something that's strange and foreign to him. So what acceptance is this going to have? You would think, you know, off the bat, it wouldn't have a whole lot of acceptance. Now, so what's Paul going to say to them? They're not hostile in the sense of filled with animosity toward him, as some of the Jews had been. But perhaps hostile in the sense that they may not be given to believe what he has to say. They may feel there's nothing he's going to say of importance. So there's a mental hostility against what he's got to say. So what's he going to say to them? What would you say? What would I say? I don't know. You know, certainly, if we think about modern philosophy, you know, modern philosophy might say that he should acknowledge their sincerity. He should speak on of things they have in common. Maybe an appreciation, you know, a shared about the universe, you know, something to that effect. A common care for the well-being of mankind. Things that we see today being spouted, you know, by people. Perhaps beautiful temples or cathedrals that they may have built there to their false gods. Perhaps comment on some of those things. Maybe he should ask them about a spiritual experience they've had. And then he could relate his spiritual experiences to them. And he could introduce Christ that way. He could talk about the road to Damascus when Jesus appeared to him. And that might be fascinating to them. Paul did talk about that in two times, Acts 22 and previous to that Acts 22 and Acts 26. But the purpose of the night was not to gain an audience and cause them to listen. The purpose was that he was telling them how it was that he left his former life of persecuting Christians and what had happened to him on that road to cause him to change. Perhaps he could talk about spiritual values. These are things that the philosophers would talk about. Love and compassion. Stay away from this dogma that divides us. You see, even the discussions today between those in our society who believe in Jesus Christ, their discussions with those who don't believe in Christ perhaps are not centered around Christ at all, but believe that each is acceptable to God through his own system of belief. He could compliment on their zealousness. They had many idols out there, many idols. One idol was even to the unknown God. Very zealous. So perhaps he could even compliment them on that. But he didn't do these things. He didn't do these things. He went straight to who God is. Now you remember in the 13th chapter of Acts, as Paul preached to the brethren, to the Jews and devout Greeks there in Antioch, we looked at those verbs that were used where God made, God did, and we saw that behind each of those verbs was just such a description of God, his power, his ability to look ahead and such as that. And we're not going to talk about that so much in this lesson, but I want you to think about that because the same lesson is there. some of the same verbs are used, and they should invoke the same thoughts. I think Paul even does that himself later on in this reading to invoke some of those same thoughts. These words are not just simply small verbs, but they carry a lot of emphasis in what these verbs mean. So, in his discussion with them now in 22, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, he says, "Men and brethren, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an idol with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim unto you." So he recognizes, he acknowledges that they were very religious. He doesn't compliment them for being religious. He doesn't compliment them for their worship of these idols. But he acknowledges that they're religious. He acknowledges, he recognizes that they have a need to worship. And that's important that we recognize this. That's one of the things that's contested today. Some would say to us, "Well, you just say you have a need to worship because you do worship." Well, notice what Paul said here. He said, "What you worship as unknown." They had all of these idols, but they were so concerned that they had left one out, they wanted to be able to worship that idol as well. These were pagans who did not believe in God at all, but they felt the need to worship. So, yes.
Why would you say verse 22 is not complimentary? I mean, he wasn't gushing and flowing with his words, but his observation that they were religious and all that respects, isn't that sort of an alignment type statement? You know, saying you and I are the same in the fact we both recognize something beyond man.
I think he works to that. Okay? I think he does. When we get down in verse 28, which says, "We are indeed his offspring," I think he's working to that. And you could be right. I'm certainly not going to argue with that. But as I look at it, at this point, it's more of a recognition of what they're doing. That's the way I'm looking at it. Acknowledging that they're very religious. Because their religious nature is certainly vented in the wrong direction. They have a need to worship. They have a need to worship. I think he sees that. But I think he's just acknowledging that at this point. But allow me to make my points as we get down verse 28, as we get down there. Now, so there's some sense in which they felt inferior. We certainly understand our inferior nature to God. There's no way, and you understand this, that we can ever approach any kind of level with God. Well, they felt some level of inferiority toward whatever it was they wanted to worship. So their zealousness was to include all the possible gods they needed to worship. And so in case they missed one, they added one. Now, so what they were worshiping as unknown is what Paul seized upon. He says, "You're worshiping an unknown God. I want to declare this unknown God to you." And so he talks about, beginning in verse 24, the God who made the world and everything in it. He's talking about one God, one singular God. Now, this God, as we start to go through here, now is not going to be limited to a specific domain. He's not going to be limited to the weather. He's not going to be limited to crops or fertility or war or love or fire or water or any of the host of heaven. This God is not limited. Polytheism has many gods, but each God is restricted into some particular element or domain. And so he says here concerning this God in verse 24, who made the heaven, who made the world and everything in it. And so now we have the creator of the world. So you've got a God to the moon, and you've got a God to the sun, and you've got a God to water and all of these different things. He says, I want to tell you about the God who made all of these things. Who that before there were none of these things. They didn't exist. But this God made, created all of these things. So we have here one God with a single rule over all domains. And thus, that's the statement. He says, being Lord of heaven and earth. He's the ultimate of heaven and earth. He created it and He controls it. Now, as such, what they have built, you see, to their gods, what they have built to their gods are these altars and these temples and so forth. And it's through these things that they offer their worship unto their idols. But because this God that Paul is declaring to him is the maker of everything, then what is it that we could offer him? We can build a temple for him, but it would be fitting for him to live in it. You remember what Solomon said when the temple was dedicated? That God was too great to dwell in that temple built with their hands. Solomon acknowledged that. And Paul is acknowledging the same thing here, is that your idol temples, they're not going to hold this God, because He is the creator of the heavens and the earth and everything that's in it. And so He's Lord of everything. Now, as supreme ruler, as creator, you see, He's without superior, He's without an equal, but He also has absolute authority. Not delegated authority, but authority that belongs to Him and Him alone. That's a part of being creator and the divine supreme being that He is. So there's no way, you know, that we can do something, you see, that's going to create in God an indebtedness toward us. There's no building that we can build that's going to be so fine that God can't resist. There's no altar. There's no cathedral. There's no musical instrument that we can design and build and play and because God to become indebted to us. There's no voice that we can train to sing to a perfect pitch that's going to cause God to be indebted to us. Rather, no matter what it is that we have to offer to God, God made us. God's our creator. And there's nothing that we can give Him from our hands that he needs. Now, as we continue this thought, I remember in when I was in business, we'd go to homes, and particularly this would be of Asian people, and they would have outside of their home a little statue made out of probably cement. And they would have two little bowls, one they would put rice in and one they would put water in. And the idea was a spirit would come there at night and would eat of this water and eat of this rice. And so here's the idea that in so oftentimes in the pagan world, there's something that the spirit, their God, needs from us. So man would have to supply. And so what Paul is saying to them is, our God is not that way. There's nothing He needs from us. He doesn't need us to give Him a bowl of water and a bowl of rice at night. He doesn't need anything from us because of who He is. He is the Creator and everything belongs to Him. In Psalms chapter 50, the psalmist says, verse 1, the mighty God, the mighty one, God the Lord, speaks and summons the earth. In verse 3, our God comes. He does not keep silence. Before Him is a devouring fire. In verse 4, He calls to the heavens above and to the earth that He may judge His people. Verses 9 and 10, I will not accept a bull from your house or goats. For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. And in verse 12, if I were hungry, I would not tell you. For the world and its fullness are mine. That's out of Psalms 50. And the writer of Chronicles wrote in the first Chronicle letter, chapter 29, beginning in verse 14. He says, beginning in verse 10 or 11. Yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heavens is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all. In verse 12, both riches and honor come from you, and you rule over all. In your hand are power and might, and your hand is to make great and to give strength to all. In verse 13, and now we thank you, our God, and praise your glorious name. 14, but who am I, and what is my people, that we should thus be able to offer willingly? For all things come from you, and of your own we have given you. See, that's what was said in the Old Testament concerning this God. Everything belongs to him. And so this is what Paul is saying. So here we have, as we looked at how Paul taught, he's using principles, truths that are taught in the Old Testament, truths that are taught in the Scriptures. He's not necessarily showing the history that's behind these. He didn't talk about the temple and the building of the temple. He didn't talk about God's work specifically with some of the nations. But the principles that he's talking about, the points that he's talking about, are well founded within Scripture. These are not new points. These are points that have been made in other scenarios, just like we discussed from the psalmist and from the Chronicle letter. So instead of we giving to him, we building all these things and building with our own hands and glorifying in what we have done, it says he gives. He gives to all mankind. He gives even to those who don't worship him. Notice verse 25. Nor is he served or worshipped by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. See, there's nothing we can give God. Instead, he gives to us. He gives us life. He gives us breath. He gives us everything that we have, everything that we need. So, looking at verse 26, notice Paul says, coming out of his creation and is not needing to be served by man, it says he made from one man every nation of mankind. This is Paul's affirmation of the creation of man. See, it's not taught today that all of us nations came from one man. But Paul says that's what happened. One man. And all of the nations came from that one man to live on the face of the earth. And this God, see, he made. It's a big word there. He made man. And out of man came every nation, having determined the allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. So we have here this idea of God determining. Hence, there's a growth, there's control. He's not only the giver of life and breath, but it's the substance. It's the essence of our living here on this earth. The fact that we can, you know, we can live in a society that's ordered. We can work and earn a living. We can have and care for a family. We can adapt to this earth. All of this is a part of this creation process and this sustaining us that we have. It all came from God. I don't know that those who worship the idols would have any kind of explanation that even could venture to establish, you know, how we are, what we are, how it came into being. But here we've got in this reading that he's determined the allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. And certainly we know of that through Old Testament history. Abraham told to, you know, look north and south and east and west, and all that he could see God would give him, meaning he was going to take it from somebody else and give to him. In Isaiah, I remove the boundaries of peoples. I bring down those who sit on thrones. When Rehoboam became king, things happened that the Lord might fulfill his word, a turn of affairs that the word of the Lord might be fulfilled. In Zechariah chapter 9, Tyre was a city that thought it was impenetrable. that nobody could war against that city. They found out differently. They were brought down, and God took credit for that. So why does God do this? Why is it? Look in verse 27. In order that they should seek God in the hope they might feel the way toward Him and find Him. See, God is worthy of our all. He's worthy of our worship. He's worth more than silver and gold. But it's that we may seek Him and that we might make the effort to find Him. Now, we might think that such a search would be overwhelming. Here's this God, such a creator. How can He be approachable? How could we dare to have an avenue to this magnificent God that's just over everything? I'm not even an ant, you see? How could I hope to ever approach Him? Well, you know, David said to Solomon in 1 Chronicles 28 and 9, he talked about, seek Him and He shall be found by you. Notice that. Seek Him and He'll find you, and He shall be found by you. You'll find Him. So we talk about this idea of one who's never heard. You know, how's he going to hear? The proverbial man in Africa on a mountaintop who's never heard the gospel. How's he going to hear? Well, the bottom line is, God is not like the needle in the haystack that you're not going to find. If you seek Him, if this Gentile seeks Him, if this man in some faraway continent, and they don't know how to read and write, if that person seeks Him, he shall be found by Him. God shall be found by Him. That promise to Solomon is a promise to everybody. He will be found. And so we can ask ourselves why. We can ask ourselves how. And you can spend your time asking that if you want to. I don't know the answer to it. I don't know if you'll ever find the answer to it. The eunuch didn't know how it was done. In his case, God found a way. Now, it involved another man, it involved the Spirit and an angel going directly to that man. And I'm not suggesting that's the way God would do it today, but God can work today. See, the Pentecostals limit God, thinking God only can work through the miraculous. That's wrong, to limit God that way. God can work through something that's not miraculous. God can work through ways that we can't imagine. It's God's end of the stick, how He's going to make it happen. It's God's end of the stick, how He's going to be found. It's our end of the stick to seek Him. It's our end of the stick to go teach others. That may be the way they're going to be found. But it's our end of the stick to teach. It's our end of the stick to seek God. God's end of the stick is how it's going to happen. I don't know. So I don't give thought to that. Except let's just teach His Word. And let's teach it on the opportunities that we have to anybody that we can, as well as we can teach it. And then we'll let God take care of the rest of it. So, As we continue in this reading, it says in verse 28, "For in Him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your poets have said, for indeed His offspring." See, our essence of being is within God. He gives life and meaning and purpose to everything that we do. There is no worthwhile meaning to life or purpose in life outside of God. Now, man tries to make purpose and meaning to life outside of God, but there is none. Everything is within God that He provides for us. It's more than just substance. It's more than just the rain. But it's the actual meaning to life and the importance of life that we have through God. And He acknowledges the writing of some of their prophets, for we are indeed His offspring. Now, evidently, their prophets, and these would be the Greek prophets, recognized that there was a sense in which man came from a God. And so I think Paul wants to capitalize on this point. The Greeks acknowledged a deity. Now, I don't take this as a compliment about their recognition, but as an acknowledgement about what they recognized. They recognized that in some sense there is a deity of which we are his offspring. Now, I don't know what detail was in their mind about how we would have become the offspring of this idol god, but evidently there was this concept in their mind. So in some sense, life was given through this deity. So if that's the case, then why engage in all this idol worship, all these other idols? Why have an idol worship to the fire and the sun and the moon and the water and the rain and on and on and on? Why have all these many gods? If there's one God through whom we have come, why would you not give homage to that one God? So now he shows them that this concept of coming from a God, in their case it's a little g God, he wants to move them from thinking of this little g God to think of this God who created the heavens and the earth. That's the God. You've got the wrong God in mind as the one who, from which we all have come, from whom we are the offspring of. It's the God that I've been declaring to you who created heavens and earth. That's the God that you need to know about. Not some deity that you've got in mind that has no power, did no creation, does not care for you, cannot do anything for you, that you only worship with something you made with your hands, and outside of that, there's nothing between the two of you. So I think this is the point that he's trying to make here. It works up to in verse 28. Now he brings in, now being God's offspring, capital G, you see, not a little g offspring, being God's offspring, we ought not. Now here's an ought, okay? We ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. So because we are his offspring, there's an ought. There's something that we ought. He says here in this verse that God is a divine being. He's one who is eternal and worthy of our worship and service. That's part of this expression, divine being. He's active. He's alive in our affairs. He has the right to rule and to judge. And we'll see that in verses 30 and 31. All of this is a part of being this divine being. He's not a force. He's not electricity. He's not magnetism. He's not light. He's not heat energy. He's not abstract. He's not somebody that can't be related to. So he's talking about what God is, a divine being. And this divine being, gold and silver means nothing. It means nothing to him. He's a creator of this world. He's a creator of gold and silver. What we would give to him, he has already given to us first. So there's nothing that we can craft that would be pleasing to him on its own right. Now, he goes on to say then that in verse 30, the times of ignorance God overlooked. Not overlooked in the sense of, that doesn't matter, we'll just forget about the past. Not overlooked in that sense, but overlooked in the sense that he allowed it to continue. He allowed them to continue in their idolatry. But now that's come to an end. It's not going to happen that way anymore. It's got to change. And we've got the, when we look in the passages such as chapter 14. I mentioned to you that 14 has some similar thought processes. He says in verse 17 of chapter 14 of Acts, yet he did not... let's go over to verse 16. Verse 16. In past generations, he led all the nations to walk in their own ways. That's the same statement as used here. He allowed these nations to walk in their own ways. And so here he's talking about the times of ignorance God looks at, but now he makes a command. He has three points here. One is that in these next verses, 30 and 31, he sets the standard for righteousness. God has the power and the authority to set the standard of righteousness. Secondly, he commands us. He's got the power and the authority to command us to live by that standard of righteousness. And the third point is, he has the right and the authority to judge people who fail to live to that standard of righteousness. So based upon that, he says there's going to be a judgment in which there will be through a man whom we know to be Jesus Christ. And he's given assurance of that by raising him from the dead. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, some said, we'll hear more later. And Paul left their midst, but it says, joined him were the people that we mentioned earlier, Dionysius, the Areopagite, Demetrius, and others. Let me make one last point. Dionysius the Areopagite. Evidently, he was one of the judges that would sit and judge these things that they heard. And evidently, he judged this to be true. He judged this as more rational, more of a reasoning process than all that could be reasoned out through their idol gods. So it's interesting that one of the men who sat upon their seats of judgment was one who responded to the gospel. Thank you. Next week, we'll begin chapter 18.